It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
And that's why I don't sing on the air anymore. Because it comes out like that.
Mm. Well, it's not as bad as you think.
I feel it's off-brand.
Okay.
You know? I mean, it hurt my public image.
Whatever you think is best, I'll defer to your opinion.
So, does it feel like it's been a week?
No.
It's only been, like, 10 minutes. But, spending 10 minutes with you kind of feels like a week.
So, they're listening and it's the equinox today.
Ooh, yeah. Fall has begun.
Where I encourage people to be equinoxious. Technically, it's the middle of fall, but that's fine.
What?
Yeah, it's... People often say that fall begins now, but it's the middle of fall.
When did fall start?
Like the beginning of August. You know, it's like, when's midsummer?
Yeah, that midsummer has always bugged me. Because midsummer is on the day that people say is the first day of summer.
It's the solstice.
Yes.
Where I tell people to be solstice ruptus.
No. But, no, solstice delicious.
But they also call... the solstice in winter, midwinter, they call it that. Well, that means the equinoxes are in the middle of the seasons, not at the beginning. Which makes perfectly good sense when you think about it.
Yeah, but then it shifts everything really weird.
Well, it depends on what latitude you live in. In Iowa, historically, even though spring starts at the beginning of February, you don't get spring-like weather until... It used to be not until close to April, but now, of course, it's in March.
Yeah.
But that's just because we live a particular latitude. But yes, it makes perfectly good sense that the middle of summer would be the longest day of the year, and the middle of winter would be the shortest day of the year, whatever you want to say. And so that means that the equinoxes are the middle of their respective seasons as well.
See, and what I'm about to say totally runs counter to that, because, I mean... I'm probably still going to stick with the ones that, like, the news say and stuff, just because it's easier. It's sort of like, I may think daylight savings is dumb, but I'm not going to not do it, because it'll fuck everything up, you know?
Right.
But, this being said, when I was younger one time, I didn't own this, I'm confident, I was in some sort of gift shop, bookstore kind of place, and there was a Berenstain Bears book that was all about the months of the year. In this book, it had which months were in what seasons. Now, I have always been raised to think of December, January, February as the winter months. March, April, May, spring months. June, July, August, summer months. September, October, November, autumn months.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it was... presented in my household, yes. In school.
This book had January, February, March were winter months. April, May, June, spring months. July, August, September, summer months. October, November, December, autumn months. And I was as scandalized as a small child can be about a Berenstain Bears book. I thought, this is insane. What the hell is wrong with these bears?
But that's,
as a child, I asked that a lot. What the hell is wrong with these bears? It came up a lot.
But that's how it would sort of roughly break down.
That's what I figured out later. Because the way that we claim it, first day of winter is December like 22nd or whatever. Right. That means virtually none of December is winter.
That's right.
And almost all of March is.
That's correct.
So then it works. But it just messed with my head. And really where I think the months come from, in my head, and probably a lot of people, is that was summer break, was June, July, August. Yeah. So therefore, that was summer.
That's correct.
But in reality, you know, based on the thing, most of June, still spring.
But then you called the first semester of school the fall semester.
Yes, because so then that was when fall supposedly was
basically
going.
Basically, all the months before winter break or Christmas break were fall. And then, so winter start, and that also coincided more or less with what the weather looked like it was doing.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's just kind of how you start to think about it.
Yes, so I think what we're verifying here is when you combine this with global warming, I don't even know why we keep talking about seasons. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't,
By the way, how do you spell Berenstain? It's
just B-E-R, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
The controversial part is the last part.
The stain?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
S-T something something N. So it's E-I or I-E?
S-T-A-I-N. Like the word stain.
No.
Yes, it is.
Really?
Yeah.
That's gross.
Now, there's a controversy about this. Because there are some people who are so certain that in their childhood that it was not spelled that way, that it was spelled the way you just said, that it actually is proof of alternate realities.
Ooh.
There are people who really believe this. It's called the Mandela effect, because the first person to bring it up, they insisted that at some point, not very long ago, that, well, actually, when Nelson Mandela passed away,
yes,
these people, apparently a significant number of people, responded to that news event by saying, wait, he died in prison. I know he died in prison. I remember there was a big news thing about it. I remember I was crushed when I heard about it. And they're so certain it happened, which of course it didn't, but they're so certain it happened that they think this is evidence of alternate realities. And the Berenstain Bears thing has become part of this whole thing of people insisting that in an alternate version of reality, Nelson Mandela died in prison, and some people remember that version, and in an alternate version of reality, Berenstain was spelled differently, and they remember that reality. However, they'll go home to the books that they remember reading as a child over and over again, and it's spelled S-T-A-N at the end, and they just know it was not
spelled
that
way. This is a surprisingly common phenomenon, because Cracked has done several articles on this, of, like, famous pop culture things that we all remember that didn't happen. And one of the classic ones that I think has been really effectively debunked is Independence Day, Will Smith punches the alien and says, "Welcome to Earth." He never says that.
Yeah, what does he say?
I don't remember, but it's not that. Well, and of course, if you're a little bit more racist, you remember him saying, "Welcome to Earth," but that's a different... No, seriously, a lot of people remember it that way. But recently had some... Jerry Seinfeld, on the show Seinfeld, at no point in that show, including a little opening thing where he did stand-up, did he ever say, "Did you ever notice?" He never said that. I believe Costanza did a couple times when he was talking about that kind of humor or whatever, but no, he never said. There's a few of them like that, that, like, you remember, or something that, like, is the signature thing for somebody, and it's like, they never actually did that. But the other people, frequently it's somebody else said it in comparison later, and then that became the norm.
I just find it interesting that people would rather insist that they have proof for experiencing alternate realities, rather than admit that they maybe aren't remembering this right.
Yep, nope, that's how that shit works.
I mean, there's plenty of
evidence. That aspect is the part that surprises me the least.
There's plenty of evidence to show how unreliable one's memory is. As if someone needs scientific evidence, I mean, just the course of your life, you should learn how unreliable your own memory is, right? I mean, because you're going to be wrong sometimes, and that should teach you, okay, well, I can't always rely on my memory then.
Well, I'll put it this way. During... the height, and I know it still goes on because fuck everything. During the height of the Obama birther conspiracy theory.
Thanks, Obama.
The chairman of it was Mr. Donald Trump. He was the big one pushing for it forever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
Okay.
And he pushed for it. So, like, he was still pushing for it when Ann Coulter was like, "Nah, I think we've covered it." But, eventually, when he produced the right birth certificate and all that shit, even Donald Trump was like, "Yeah, I guess that's not true." Mm. And if anybody out there is so convinced that they're right of things that they would say, well, if you just prove my memory wrong, that just means that that memory is from an alternate reality. It is that man. Which, by the way, I don't like to talk about him so much anymore, but I realized something the other day, because every once in a while I have these fictitious conversations in my head with Trump supporters, because I've never heard a Trump supporter give, like, a clear explanation of what they're supporting in him. And to be fair, you hardly hear about that in general. Usually when people are talking about their favorite presidential candidate, they just speak in broad, stupid terms. But you can usually be like, okay, what's a thing? And that's how I've never heard that, so I always kind of imagine asking them the things. So I always assume they're going to ask me back, you know, what's the thing? And I realized it sums up really well. And this is, I can honestly say I have never felt this way about any significant presidential candidate. Certainly none who ever got the nomination from one of the two major parties, but also ones that were close. I've never felt this way. With Donald Trump, I genuinely feel I would make a better president. I don't want the job, and I would be bad, but I genuinely feel I would be better than him. And I've never said that. Didn't say that about boring-ass John Kerry. Didn't say that about freaky Mitt Romney. Didn't say that about George W., who I really think is a waste of component elements. I still don't think I would be better, because I am super not suited to be the president. But I would be better than Donald Trump. Anyway, off topic.
Yep, but in eighth grade, you'd be better than Donald Trump.
I'm pretty much an eighth grader, yeah. Okay. No, but I just want to make clear that I'm not being hyperbolic here. I genuinely believe that. No, eighth graders are assholes. They fit into that image pretty well. Anyway, interesting thing I just recently learned about the Berenstain Bears.
Yeah.
The Berenstain Bears went through a shift that some people noticed and others did not so much notice. Berenstain Bears had a lot of books, and it was about a lot of kid things, you know. Brushing your teeth, you know, oh, trouble with bully at school, or, you know, shit like that, you know, just things that kids care about and nobody else cares about, you know, that kind of stuff. But at a certain point, there was a shift that happened, and the stories, all of the stories, started being about God. And apparently that's because the Berenstain Bears, like, I don't know, V.C. Andrews or some other authors, has lived on past the actual authors. And the Berensteins, who wrote them, dead. Their son, still alive, still making books. Their son also, devout born-again Christian. So now he makes them all about Jesus and God and shit like that. So, that's just an interesting fun fact. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the world that'll talk about the Berenstain Bears and Donald Trump for 12 minutes before starting, and still record it.
Yeah.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William. This is episode 289.
And it's the past. I mean, it's always the past. Like, we don't do this live, so by definition. Although, one recently, remember, like, a couple episodes ago where I was talking in high talk at the end? Every time I explained what was going on with the podcast?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised you're not laughing, because that cracked you up at the time.
It did.
I finished, posted and everything, went, I'm watching TV, and I get a text from my boss, just says, up talk much? And I'm like, I don't even know what this means. And I tell Trish, I say, my boss just sent me a thing that said, up talk much. I have no idea what she's talking about. And Trish, because she's awesome, is like, well, I can give you the speech pathologist take on it, because she was a speech pathologist. She's like, uptalk is that thing where you raise the timbre at the end so it kind of sounds like a question. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, she's already listening to the podcast. It's been out for like an hour. And that was what it was. So sometimes people listen pretty close to the present, but technically it's in the past, but this time it's a week in the past. So for us, it's September 15th, and for you guys, as we've established, it's mid-autumn.
Yes, mid-autumn.
Equinoxious.
Equinoxious.
Equinoxious and solstitious. They go around the country solving mysteries.
Which one am I? Which, am I
Joe Equinoxious is a former cop turned PI. He's got demons and drinks heavily, but he won't talk about what knocked him off the force.
Okay.
Janice Solstalicious is a former stripper with a heart of gold who realized she's actually really fucking brilliant and should probably not be stripping and instead should, like, solve crimes.
Dude, this sounds like a good show. That.
Yeah, right?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yep.
Someone's going to make this show and be rich and you're going to be so mad.
And it's going to be played by Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally.
Oh, hey, that's a good idea. That's an even better idea.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Good show.
Great show.
Equinoxious and Solstalicious.
You're good. You're good. You should be working in Hollywood or wherever people work.
I should write a novel.
Yeah, but you're doing
it. Oh, yeah. Well, there we go then.
Yeah, but these two people that you just said aren't the stars of that story.
No, but I could write a series of mystery books.
Oh, boy, that was... Do it. Oh, that would be so
Equinoxious
awesome.
Equinoxious and Solstalicious.
And you could totally have those two actors in your mind so you can kind of write
it.
That would be good. That would be a smashing success with at least both of us. And maybe some of our listeners.
It is interesting in writing the novel how much I'm balanced. I don't want it to be a comedy novel. I don't want it to be a Terry Pratchett Discworld thing. Not that there's anything wrong with that. That's just not what I'm going for. But it has funny bits in it. And more importantly, I feel like it should have funny. Funny is kind of a thing I do. Mm. And it's probably something I'm better at than most other things. So I feel like, you know, play to your strength, put comedy in. But I'm trying to walk that line. It's very weird. I do have some lines I really like, some of which we'll probably have to get edited out. Kind of like how my very first draft had two references to Short Round from Temple of Doom, and those disappeared by version 1.5.
The thing I'm working on has some comedy in it, although I don't think there was much in the episode that you read.
There was definitely not.
No, it was a pretty heavy episode. But the rest of them have some comedy moments in them. But it's not supposed to be a comedy, really. Which is part of the difficulty, I think, because it's definitely... There are things about it, about the, like the title and the aesthetic, that makes you think pulp. And nowadays, pulp is all ironic and funny.
Yeah.
Long gone is the earnest aspect of pulp,
which
I, of course, still have in what I'm writing, that earnestness. But it's not without humor after you get past the first episode. The first episode's pretty heavy.
And again, I feel like I borrowed a lot of inspiration from Jim Butcher and Dresden Files, and that's full of funny stuff. One thing that, for some reason... I was just thinking of when we were talking here. I finally figured out it's sort of a trend in his books. Near the end, when he comes up with the plan that's going to solve everything, somebody's always like, so what's the plan? And I told them, and then they say something about how terrible that plan is. But my favorite one time is he's talking with another character, and he's like, so, what's the plan? So I told him the plan. That is a bad plan, he said. That was just it.
That is a bad plan.
That is a bad plan. So yeah, I like using that line. What's the plan? And I told him, that is a bad plan. Alright, so what do you think is going to happen to you this week? Well, I am hoping this weekend I'm going to get through the rereading of the text of the novel so that I can start writing.
Yeah, I'll be working a lot on episode 3 of My Little Saga.
I'm hoping also to install that television in our bedroom.
I see.
That is the television that we got free for getting my phone. Mm. It was a deal they had going. And we were very confused because it didn't show up and it didn't show up. And we're like, Jesus, how long is this going to take? And so then Trish looked into it and it turned out they only ship it after I forget how many days. But it's enough days so that like you actually had to pay for the... So you can't just say, oh yeah, I want a TV. Oh no, taking the phone back. You know, that kind of deal. And it is a smart TV. So Trish in particular is very excited, because now she can be back there and do Netflix, Amazon Prime, all that kind of stuff on the giant, well, not giant, but big TV. So, hoping to do that this weekend. And then work will just be work. Actually, next weekend, we're having a gaming weekend with my in-laws. So my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, and my youngest sister-in-law, and Trish and I, are all going to meet up at a hotel in the Quad Cities and spend a couple days just playing games.
Mm. Yeah, I think you told me about that.
We've done it before. We've done it before a few times. It's fun.
Yeah, sounds like fun.
Yeah. So, you're going to work on episode 3?
Yep.
The search for Spock?
No.
The search for Hawk.
I think I talked before about how I was looking into having an illustrator work
played
on
by
it.
James Avery in purple suit and sunglasses.
And it turns out that illustrator is busy on another project at the moment. So, but because that kind of came up, like, oh, I know this illustrator. I know he's looking for maybe a project to work on. I'll pitch this product, but my project. But it turns out someone got to him before me, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's fine, but now I'm thinking, well, why don't I just keep looking for illustrators? You know, just
I like it because I really think it would work as a graphic novel better than a TV show.
Just keep doing that. I mean, eventually, after God knows how long, even if it takes a couple years, I'll just keep working on it. And if I find someone who's excited about it, that would be great. So I might find some way to just keep sort of casting a line to see if I can. I would love it if a female artist could get excited about the project. You know, that's what I want. I want someone who would read the pitch or read the episode and go, oh man, I really love this.
I can't wait
to draw this world that you've created. I love these characters.
I'd say hold out for that. Don't just do somebody who's willing to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's somebody who's excited about it.
And it would be great if it was a woman, because I think that that's probably one of those fields that women don't get to work in as often as they'd like.
Yeah.
It would just be nice, and if I can find that person and they are willing to do a couple pieces just to sort of get some images out there for a Kickstarter and Indiegogo, whatever you use, or Patreon even if we wanted to go that route, then we could, you know, get the money together to actually produce it, and that would be pretty cool. I think you're right. I think it would be a good graphic novel.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
That's kind of how I'm planning to handle stuff with the novel. So I'm going to write it. Well, I did write it. I'm going to write it more. And then have you guys edit it and all that stuff. But anyway, at some point, it's going to be done.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to try and get it published. And that's going to be a long, complicated process that might not work. And I think my plan is, during the realistically years while I try and do that, I'll just write the next one.
Sure, yeah.
And at some point, if it just looks, it's just never going to happen, I will self-publish, because I want to be able to eventually have a book that I can tell people, here is a book I wrote, read it.
Yeah, right.
So if I have to, I will eventually go that route. But I do not think that route is good for me, especially if I try and imagine this as something I do for a living.
Sure.
So I'll go other routes. But yeah, that's the thing is, I'm trying to keep it this way, and lately it's more so this way. I would love to be a professional writer and make a living doing that, but that can't be what this is about. This is about me having a novel I want to write.
Yeah, right.
And it's becoming much more that now, and I'm very pleased about that.
Yeah, you should be.
So, yeah. All right, hat?
Mm-hmm.
How did I get the hat over here again?
It's, I don't know.
Oh, I guess we did two last time, and I drew the second one, so. Usually we do one, and so it stays with you.
That's right.
Izzy pants, does whatever an Izzy pants does. Can she swing from a web? No, she can't. She's a cat.
I am catching up on late episodes while doing DIY.
I believe it's pronounced D.
But like a do-it-yourself? I mean,
yeah, that's what it is. It's not. You really thought there was a thing called D?
No, I'm not sure I understand what that means. But the question is, are you happy now, Tony?
Oh, okay.
Because you keep encouraging people to find ways to listen.
Yes. My hunch is, and I'm not verifying this, so anonymity is maintained. I feel like this is probably Craig because of the DIY comment. Because that's a Britishism. I mean, we know what it means here, but you would say, like, doing DIY, which would be the equivalent of, like, doing stuff around the house, oh, basically. Okay. So he's probably, like, trying to build an atrium or some shit. I don't know. And also, recently, we had a thing from him that said he was behind on, like, 10 episodes or whatever. So, yes, Craig, I am happy. Keep it up. I hope you've caught up by now.
And I'm also happy. I mean, you didn't ask.
No, he doesn't care.
Okay.
But William is happy. Other people might care if William is happy about this, so we'll let you know. Yes, he is. Yeah. Bitch at me. I'm not your brother. I'm your dad who's just fucking with you with his big toe. Part of having children is the joy of getting to mess with them.
Don't fight over my boot.
People have a very strong opinion frequently about the idea of referring to your pets as though they were your children.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, the people who don't do it really think it's just wrong and terrible and weird. I used to be a little more hesitant, and I just didn't fucking embrace it now. And that's the thing. We anthropomorphize the hell out of these pets. Well, anybody's been listening to this podcast knows that.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, I probably didn't explain how it works, but you know what? If you're new, just this episode, stop. Go back and listen to the last week episode. Mm-hmm. It'll be fine. Like, there's so many things I think about what they think and what they're doing that I'm totally making up. Because you can't use social cues you would use with humans with cats.
Mm-hmm.
And we totally embrace the whole parent thing or whatever. So, they're my babies. So, deal with it. All right, give me that. Thanks for your question, Craig. It brought us hours of delight.
If it was Craig, maybe it wasn't.
Thanks for your question, Anonymous, maybe Craig. Do you think anger has its uses? Jazz. Yes, how else do you do force lightning? Right? I mean, or the choke? I don't think you can do the choke if you're not angry. It's a lot of dark side shit that doesn't work unless you're angry.
That's pretty good. Well done. Well done. you know, emotions are tricky to talk about because...
You don't know how you feel about them?
In our culture, we don't really have a standardized vocabulary for talking about emotions. Whenever someone's talking, you know... I have a problem with this generally when people are having a conversation and they don't seem to be interested in establishing what their definitions are. But they don't. I mean, it's very uncommon when people are having a conversation when you can tell they're talking right past each other. And what they just need to do is decide how each person is defining this word. And they don't have to agree on what the definition is. They just have to understand how the other person is defining it. They totally refuse to do it. Everybody's going to insist upon their own frame, which means they're never going to get together on this thing. And emotions is one of those things where everybody's got their own frame, they've got their own definitions within said frame, and so a lot of times people can't talk about them because they'll never just stop and decide if they're even talking about the same thing. Now, anger is a good example of one of those things. So it's hard to, I don't know, it depends on what you mean. But if by anger you mean... Like what kinds of anger, I guess, is what I'm wondering, are useful? For example, I think it's useful if you are witnessing some kind of injustice, however you want to define that, if it makes you angry. Because... I think that physiological, emotional response, whatever you want to call it, I think it might move you to do something about it, which is a good thing. But that's one example I can come up with where anger would be useful, I think.
Do you remember The mad scientist in Looney Tunes?
No. Well, or you mean the one with where you made that giant robot and
possibly, but I feel like he was a recurring one, and his whole shtick was they'd talk about him being a mad scientist, and he'd say, I'm not mad! I'm a lunatic.
No, I don't remember
that.
That
was his line. I largely agree with you, but I think you're actually trying to get a little... I feel like you are using unnecessary specificity. In that what you described is a useful and, I guess, ethical situation. But that's the thing. She asks, when is anger useful? It could still be useful in something that you and I, like, are horrified by.
I don't.
So we're talking about the practicality of it. So I would say, just in general, anger can be useful in situations where anger prompts you to action. But it needn't necessarily be injustice.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Anger when it has potency. Anger when it makes you do something, then it's useful. Anger, far too common, and I get it, where you just sort of sit at home and bitch to yourself or to the person who has the misfortune of living with you and hearing you bitch. That's not so useful. But I find... overall, it is not useful for the type of life I want to lead. Even in circumstances of injustice, if I can approach it not from a perspective of anger, I find that preferable. There are exceptions, but they're just that. And I find that I frequently am like, well, you know, the way I want to live is like this. But just this once, I'm not going to live that way. And it's mostly me just giving in to the anger. It's not like, tactically, I think it is a good idea this time, you know. So, for how I want to live my life, I don't know that anger is ever useful. But for people in general, it can be useful, I think, in that when it can spur you to action. And, you know, I don't do a lot to combat injustice, so maybe I should give into the anger.
Well, I guess what I was getting at with the whole injustice thing was that I think there are times where, in my opinion anyway, anger is an appropriate response. Like, I mean, although
and it is a way that could be very useful to you in the way you live your life. Yeah. Right. And although you and I share a lot of similar views with regard to social justice, I still try and be a good pacifist and at heart, to the degree that I don't like being angry. And even at things that I obviously should be angry at. I just don't like that emotion. I don't know what it is.
Well, I don't think anybody does. But the thing is...
Oh, no, I think some people thrive on it and love it. I mean, they might not admit it and they might not think it, but...
Really?
Oh, yeah. Hmm. People... you've never heard of rageaholics?
No.
That's a thing. Hmm. In fact, they have their own anonymous groups. Rageaholics Anonymous. As Homer Simpson said, I'm addicted to rage-a-hole. Homer Simpson's not that bright, though.
But are they really? Is it really the anger that they're into, or is it something they think the anger is giving?
Well, I think there's a...
Although there are chemicals being released, so maybe that's part of it.
Well, frequently, anger comes with a sense of righteousness.
And superiority?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think people get into that.
Yeah,
they like being angry
because
it's like, then I'm right, clearly. And I'm mad about the fact that you're so wrong.
Indignation.
Exactly.
I got you. But there are chemicals involved. Maybe
you can get
addicted to that, just like thrill-seeking or lots of other...
And I can get some weird confusion. I have a tendency, well, and we've seen it, I get more enthusiastic and pointedly louder when I am more engaged in a conversation. but consequently sometimes it will appear to people that I am angrily shouting at them, when in fact that is not what I am intending, but that's just how it translates for me. I get louder, I get shoutier when I'm just into something, and in both directions. If I'm getting involved in something because it's making me angry, I'll also do that. But if I'm getting involved just because it sounds really cool or whatever, sometimes I'll still sound like I'm angry about it.
Yeah. Well, I know sometimes I've said on the podcast that I feel angry and I'm not happy about this.
Yeah.
And what I mean in those situations isn't what I was talking about before, where something happens, it makes you angry, and then it leads to you doing something. This anger is kind of this simmering, just, there's, you know, you can't do anything about it. You're totally helpless to change anything, and you're just sitting in it. You know, that's not something I think is helpful, useful, or that, because a lot of the times when I see something and I get angry about it, I don't stay angry. You know what I mean? I'll be angry at first, and then I'll decide I'm going to do something about it. And then after a while, I'm doing these things, but I'm not angry anymore. I'm just doing stuff.
Or sometimes I get angry at something, and then after more
reflection, I'm like, exactly,
I shouldn't be mad about
But a lot of times on the podcast when I've talked about being angry and how this is a problem for me, I'm talking about this, it's just an emotion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that it's not tied to things that have happened in my life or are happening, but it's mostly just this thing that's sitting there and it won't go anywhere.
Well, and sometimes you can tell. Sometimes you're like, I've experienced comparable things that didn't make me this mad.
What is going on?
And sometimes you learn that, oh, that's because of this unique thing. And other times you're like, oh, that's because of this unrelated thing.
Right, but
or,
even...
Or that's because I haven't eaten in 12 hours.
But even if what I mean by connected to things in my life, I mean, like, before this thing happened, I wasn't angry like this.
Yeah.
And so this thing contributed to that happening or made that happen. But that thing's not around anymore.
Yeah.
And yet the feeling is just still there.
It broke the dam.
Yeah,
and then,
or something, yeah.
But so here's an interesting...
And so it's just going to take longer for it to go away or something. I don't know.
Here's a meta question that probably is just a silly semantic thing. But so when you're angry and it's a problem for you and you don't want to be and you're not... You're unhappy that you're angry.
Yeah, it's just... It's,
are you unhappy that you're angry? Or are you unhappy that the situation that is making you angry exists? Obviously, in those situations where you say that's gone, that doesn't count. But if something is making you angry, are you bothered that you're angry, or are you bothered by the thing existing that is making you angry? In which case, are those the same? Okay, I'm getting into weird, like, stoner logic here. Mm. It's like, is the angry and the unhappy really just the same emotion, man?
I think the problem is... okay, I think I can relate what it is to an experience that most people have had. This isn't the situation I'm in, but I think that it's the same kind of thing. When...
You're going to sit down and eat a big steak...
Actually, there are two things I can bring up, and one of these things, or both of them, are going to be something hopefully listeners will relate to. Either if someone very close to you passes away, or if someone who you've been in a relationship with for a long time breaks up with you.
Mm-hmm.
Either one of those things, the pain of it can last a really long time.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it just. You know that the reason you're feeling the way you're feeling is because even though this thing happened months ago or even a year ago, maybe 2 years ago even, it doesn't matter. It still feels like it was yesterday, and that's just how it's going to be for a long time because of the nature of the traumatic event, really. So part of it is you just realize, I'm just not over this yet, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then... On top of that, there is what you're talking about, which is, why does this just keep going on and on?
And then it becomes cyclical.
Yeah.
Because you get mad that you're mad.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it kind of gets out of control, and then you feel depressed, and you want to get out of bed, and all this other stuff.
But, I mean, I think it's closely tied to, because at least I experienced in the kind of circumstances you're talking about, rage over my own impotence. Like, you know, this loved one died, And part of me feels like I should have been able to stop it, but obviously I could not have.
Right, exactly. If it's an ended relationship, I should have said this,
yes,
or I should have done that.
And those are the ones where I'm very much like actively trying to get myself out, because that is useless anger.
No, yeah.
Because, right. I mean, unless it spurs you to delve into the study of necromancy. And even that, well, I mean, I guess that's useful, but I mean, outside of that's just useless anger.
There can be aspects of it that where you're introspective and you learn some things about yourself, if only that you have this tendency to beat yourself up over ridiculous things.
I just thought of something.
And then you can get over that, move on, maybe.
I just thought of something.
But it's mostly useless, yeah.
Okay, this is an incredibly personal story, such that I'm going to leave out a lot of details.
Okay.
But something happened in college one time that was very traumatic to me and to other people, and I very strongly blamed myself. Mm-hmm. And I was very, I don't even want to say angry. I mean, there were a lot of emotions going on. Anger was probably in there. Just a negative emotion. I was distraught. I was unhappy. I was guilty. I was in despair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know what to do about it. And I was very self-hating. I was very, like, because very just, it was my fault.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a friend, and I tried to talk to him about it. And it wasn't really helping, because it was one of those, like, it was a combination of, when you look at it objectively, that's not your fault, in some parts. And in some parts, yeah, you did that, and that happened, and you can't undo that, so you're going to have to move on. You know, and that was not helpful.
Right.
I mean, he was doing his best, and I don't know what else he might have done, but it was not helping. Mm. And he could see it was not helping. So he said, all right, and he stood up, and he went over, and he grabbed a bag. This bag was full of weapons. They were not real weapons. They were PVC and foam weapons, because he and a bunch of my friends belong to a group called Dagger Hair, which is, it's not quite like live-action role-playing, it's just battle stuff, so it's basically live-action, like, medieval fights.
Okay.
And so they would go out and they'd hit each other with foam swords and stuff like that. And yeah, so he grabbed it and said, let's go. And we went outside into the yard, and he handed me a sword, and we started, like, fighting. And I was not very good at it, because he practices and stuff. And so it was very just sort of sparring or whatever. But in the process, he kept talking to me about it. And I would talk back, and we were still sort of like arguing about what was my fault and what wasn't. Whatever. And it eventually got to like me just like yelling all of this stuff and just wailing on him with it. And it was totally his intention. And hugely cathartic, hugely therapeutic.
Hmm.
It's the only way I got to sleep that night, and it was the beginning of me processing it.
Hmm.
And, you know, most of the credit there goes to him and coming up with this method. But part of it, during that fight, I switched from being distraught to being angry. Partially angry at me.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit angry at him, because he was kind of arguing against me that I wasn't a worthless piece of shit, and I was mad about that.
Mm-hmm.
And a little part of me thought the whole thing was a little precious and overdramatic. Mm-hmm. It was his style. And so I was like, really? This is what we're doing? But it fucking worked. And by the end, I was really mad. And it was, yeah, it was really good. So I feel like that's a very direct answer to Jazz's question, that anger can be very useful in processing other emotions,
well,
I think, and in processing situations.
They do talk about anger being one of the steps in the process of grief.
Mm-hmm. But hasn't that pretty much been proven to have just been something somebody pulled out of their ass?
I don't know.
I think I read a thing recently that, like, the person who came up with the five stages just was like, this sounds good. Like, it wasn't based off of anything.
Well,
they were just like, that sounds good.
There's a lot of stuff out there like that.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Did you see the stuff recently with sugar?
No.
It recently, not that we needed more information, but it recently came to light that a whole lot of what we believe about sugar, and to a degree actually about fat and cholesterol, was based off of blatantly fraudulent research in the 60s from the group that at the time was the Sugar Research Association, and now it's called the Sugar something.
And to shift certain dietary blame from sugar to fat.
Exactly, exactly. And to downplay the damage that happens from sugar. He's scratching his ear and he's too close to the window, so he keeps smacking the window too. That's what that sound is. But yeah, something in the 60s, not that like it was poor research, but like they manipulated and lied about the results and stuff, and that a whole bunch of things are based off of that. And so the only thing it changes is, you know how we all thought that sugar in most amounts is a terrible idea, like more than just a little bit? Apparently it's even more a terrible idea. So it's not like it's going to do a lot, but yeah, that was complete
the thing
bullshit.
About the stages of grief, though, is one of the reasons that idea has resonated so much is because a lot of people feel like it expresses their own experience with grief.
Yeah.
And people do get angry in the process of grief, and there's really not, I don't think there's really anything you can do about that. You kind of have to go through. I mean, that's a big problem with our culture. As I was saying before, in terms of dealing with emotions, we don't teach people to think of emotions. Like, we teach men that they shouldn't have emotions, and we teach women that their emotions are these random things that actually don't really mean anything. Oh, except in a romantic context, if you feel butterflies in your stomach, you're in love, or some ridiculous garbage like that. We don't really educate anybody in terms of what emotions are, what they tell you, what they don't tell you. I mean, it's a new idea to some people just to come to the realization that emotions aren't reality. Like, yeah. Like if you feel something, it's all it is a feeling.
Oh, and it's a rejected idea to some people.
It's not actually telling you anything about reality per se. Like, you can't just feel something and think that, oh, this... Because I'm scared in this context, this is all bad,
yeah.
And I have to think of all this as bad, or else I wouldn't feel
this
scared right now.
This has blatantly come up at the Republican National Convention this year. Interviews, the one I remember particularly was with Newt Gingrich, because there was a lot of talk at the RNC about people feel they're less safe, people feel this, and a lot of the things had there was research on it disproving that, and they were saying, like, why are you still pushing this? Like, they feel that, but it's not true. And they basically said, like, well, those are your two theories. You can go with what the data shows, or you can go with what people feel. And I'm going with what people feel. And
that
doesn't work.
But
feelings are not facts.
But we're not really taught in our culture to process feelings or to understand that feelings don't last forever. Like, you know, you're angry now, but you might not be angry later. And if you just sort of process through that anger, think about it, deal with it, it'll eventually go away and not come back if you deal with it in the right way. Mm-hmm. If the trauma is especially bad, though, of course, like treatments for PTSD, if you look into them, they're remarkably intuitive when you think about it. It's not something that just anyone can help you with, because PTSD is really severe and you probably need professional help. But the guts of it, you know, the mechanics of it, pretty straightforward. You know, you need to talk to a person, you need to not push the event away, you need to experience it and just let those emotions work through, you need to kind of re-experience the thing in a safe environment. This is, if you just sit down and think about it, this is how you process emotions all the time that aren't extreme or whatever. You allow yourself, maybe you get out of the situation you're in. You find a friend, a safe place who can help talk you through it, and you let the emotions sort of work their way through you, and you get over it. But this isn't something we're taught. And it's really too bad, because I just think it's a tragic thing in our culture how bad people are at processing emotion. I mean, this is one of the things with the kids we really tried to work on. What happened?
He flipped himself all the way off the kitty condo. He fell from that top thing. He was reaching up to get his brother, and he spun on his back and just fell off the end.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, no, cats do that kind of shit all the time. In fact, if we could have seen from here, he probably would have immediately adopted a pose of that he meant to do yeah, that.
Right. But we tried to teach the kids, you know, this really important skill of, look, it's okay, you feel emotions, that's all right. It's okay to feel emotions, it's okay to work through them. Talk to somebody about it, it doesn't even have to be us. Although the whole world was telling him the opposite. The whole world was telling him, you've got to be cool.
And you know, especially cool in your adolescent days, that's the one you can't ever convince a teenager of, but I wish we could convince every teenager, is the shit you're going through right now really is not going to matter pretty soon. And especially the emotions, like, you feel like this is the end of the world. It's barely a blip in your life.
But it starts so much earlier now than it used to. I mean, these kids were thinking about being cool and unemotional in all situations, and they weren't even in middle school yet.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah, I see it with the neighbor kids.
And it's just like, so...
Addy deals with it now. He's
you're trying to teach
cool.
these young people about emotional health and emotional sensitivity and emotional... a high emotional... what do they call it? Emotional quotient or whatever, EQ, yeah. they come up with now. But the whole world is telling them, no, you don't deal with emotions. You certainly don't show emotions. That's the biggest thing. You don't show what you're feeling, because as soon as people know how you're feeling, you're vulnerable and they will attack you.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you do in a culture that is teaching kids from as soon as they start school, in elementary school basically, that they have to bury their emotions and not show anybody what they're feeling and not deal with their emotions? I mean, that's terrible. You're just going to create a whole culture of messed up people, which I guess is what we're doing. I mean, isn't that why Trump is where he is? Because we have a whole.
I thought
because
we have a bunch of fucking racists.
But it leads to that type of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because you end up, if you don't deal with your own stuff,
you got to blame your emotions on something.
Yeah, and so you'll pick race, you'll pick gender, you'll pick, another ethnic group, you'll pick another political party, and that's
this
why.
Cat.
And so then, when you're having conversations with people, it's clear that you're only having an argument with someone because you're looking for someone to bully it, not because you actually care about the issues or that you actually are trying to find out what the truth of something is.
Yeah.
And you see that, of course, a lot in the way people talk. It's not that people don't know how to talk. They're talking exactly the way they want to. They're getting exactly out of this conversation what they want, which is to beat somebody up.
Pretty much everybody does that. This is one that came from Louis C.K. a little while back that I've been seeing more and more. Is everybody, especially in this country, but in the Western world as a whole, maybe in the world, I don't know, only is unwilling, not only just to do things they don't want to do, but is unwilling to do things their second favorite way. It has to be. And the example he uses in the thing is somebody who's making a left turn, but for some reason is in the right lane of like a whole bunch of stuff. So they could take an extra 30 seconds and go up two blocks turn again. Yeah. But that's not what they're going to do. They're going to cut everyone off and go all the way across traffic the whole time. Just like, sorry. Yeah. But the other way is not my favorite. This is I want to go this way. And it's just all the time. It's not even just I want to do what I want to do. I want to do my favorite thing, and I am unwilling to compromise even on my second favorite thing.
I think that is something that's mostly in our culture, and it's because narcissism is on the rise.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the whole thing, I was trying to figure this out the other day, because I've been getting angry at American exceptionalist stuff.
Yeah.
That always annoys me.
It's a real problem.
Does any other country have that? And I don't mean does any other country have American exceptionalism, because that would be weird. But is there French exceptionalism as like a political movement? Is there, you know, Japanese exception? I mean, I know there are people who are like, my country is the best, who aren't American. But is there like political movements and philosophies based around it like there is here?
Well,
I feel like there should be, because people are people, but I never hear about it.
I don't personally know of anyone other than America where...
They keep saying they're the greatest country in the world.
where American exceptionalism is a thing that the people who espouse it call it. They're calling it.
Yeah, true.
I believe, you know, there are people who say, yeah, I believe that America is exceptional. I believe America is the city on the hill or whatever.
Oh,
I believe,
tons of people say that.
I believe all that.
I would almost say the majority of Americans say that.
I I think there are other people who feel that way about their particular country, but I don't think they would say it like that.
Yeah.
I don't think... Now, I don't know, like we were talking last week, was last week for the listener, about Brexit, and it seemed like a lot of British people were speaking that way about their country. But I don't know of anyone who would have called themselves, well, I'm a Britain exceptionalist or whatever, I'm a UK exceptionalist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think our country is so much better than all the rest that I think we should get out of the EU. I don't think even the most nationalistic British person, most racist British person, was saying stuff like that.
But well, and
America,
I mean, I
call themselves American exceptionalists.
I have international friends who I got a story from one of them of they were in a situation working with an American on something, and the American's like, "Which country do you think is the best in the world?" And they were like, "Oh, well, if you mean, like, food, then, you know, I really like French food." And they're like, no, not food. Just which one's the best? I'm like, do you mean, like, in terms of art and stuff? Well, I like these ones. And they were like, no. Which country's the... And they couldn't... They're like, I don't know what you mean by the best country.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're right. I think outside the United States, that's how a lot of people think about it.
And that's all when people are like, don't you think America is the greatest country? I'm like, I think my answer is no, but my real answer is... I don't think that's a question that can be... That's not a thing.
Well, but see, another thing about American exceptionalism is the name sort of says it all in terms of what the attitude really means. It means that there are some things that America is able to do or get away with that other countries
yes.
aren't. And that is an idea that's very American. I mean, there are a lot of...
There was all sorts of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. Sure, like, American individualism, always
like,
been a thing.
The UK can think that it's the best country and everybody should listen to it, but it's not going to insist that the rules should be different for them as compared
yes.
to other people.
And it's why the US seems to have such a knee-jerk reaction against socialism, because Americans don't want to think of themselves as a society. They want to think of them as an American and an American and an
right.
American and an American.
But American exceptionalists, again, that's the exceptional part is key. We can be excluded from certain rules. For example, we can have nuclear weapons.
Good one.
Really the big one that American exceptionalism comes from.
Yes.
It says, we can have nuclear weapons because we're America.
Yep.
But
we're
really,
cool. You're not
nobody
cool
else should have them because nobody else has what we have that allows us to have nuclear
weapons. That's one of the greatest examples. Well, we always argue that secretly every war we do is about resources. The common argument there, too, when we get involved and invade or defend a country that we sort of have nothing to do with, is that, you know what? Nobody else could figure this shit out. The Americans are going to come in, clean it up.
Yeah.
Because only the Americans can handle this.
Well, and that's the thing that I'm not sure other countries, you know, like, I don't think even the most diehard British nationalist is going to say, well, we can have nuclear weapons, but nobody else can. Or... if they say they don't think a certain country should have them, it's not going to be based on the argument that, well, we're British and they're not. It's going to be based on some other
it's
argument.
It's going to be based on racism.
Usually. Well, or whatever. But the American exceptionalist argument is, it's because we're America. Mm. And that's the only argument that you need. I am deeply disturbed by that argument and that attitude. But there are a lot of people in the United States who not only make this argument, just like I did, I mean, if you're listening and you think that sounded absurd, I'm telling you, this is exactly the
Absolutely.
Way they'll argue it without any irony, without
oh, yeah.
without cracking a smile. And
most American exceptionalists are gleefully embrace the term
yeah.
and the very blunt concept is, yeah. No,
and they think saying. Anyone who doesn't agree with that, what I consider just absurd, anyone who doesn't agree with it is not a patriot.
Or just stupid.
No,
you get that too. Like,
that's true.
You just don't even get that the rest of the world is different and we're awesome.
Yeah. Now there are some people who are a lighter version of it who might not give you too hard a time if you don't agree with that philosophy. But it's just an absurd philosophy. I mean, I don't mean to offend anyone who subscribes to it, but
to,
it just is.
I mean, I totally do. I'm fine with that.
I don't see how you can defend it.
I always wondered if you could draw parallels between hardcore patriots and sports fans. And I don't mean, obviously, just in an abstract sense, but I mean, if demographically the lines run similar. Because, I mean, and I've done it with roller derby and stuff, but in general, it's a kind of alien idea to get, like, really into a team of people doing a thing that I have nothing to do with because they're my home team or whatever. I understand going to support or whatever, but, like, to the degree that, like, people will get in fist fights over it or, you know, trash cities and things like that. Like, the rabid sports fans. The fans, the fucking movie stars who come from Boston and so refuse to wear a Yankees cap for a part in a movie. Like, this kind of shit. I wonder if that's the same mentality as, like, we're Americans. Like, we're the best, and you gotta support... Well, and actually, there's a South Park episode that deals with that exact concept. At the very end, they were... One of them, they were like, I thought you didn't... were down on America. He's like, no, I just decided, you know, it's where you're from. It's your home team, and you gotta support the home team or get out of the stadium. And I'm just like, fuck you.
Well, human beings are tribal. There's just no doubt about that. I don't know why anyone even tries to argue against that concept. We're all going to...
We are over time, by the way, so do your short
version. I'm just going to say, we're all going to feel like we belong to a tribe, like we should belong to a tribe, like we want to belong to a tribe. And we're going to call that tribe a lot of, you know, for some people, it's America.
Yeah.
And these people convince themselves that everyone else who calls themselves an American and a patriot, they all think the same way and they feel the same way, even though that's clearly not the case. Yeah. So, you know, so what I'm saying is, yeah, you're right. It is the same thing because it's all, some people join a gang, some people follow a sports team, some people become really patriotic, some people join a church.
I feel like I have low tribalism. I'm not saying I have none. It definitely comes up. But in general, I don't like joining communities.
Well, the way I would put it is you have a very high standards for what constitutes a tribal connection.
Maybe. But just in general, like, I mean, and some of it is laziness, but just in general, I don't like joining, like, a politically active group or whatever. I don't...
Well, that's because it doesn't meet your standards for what a good solid connection is. I mean, tribes can be two people, you know. Two people can be a tribe.
And that's why I said low. I'm definitely not immune. And I get it sometimes in a lot of things. And I mean, I've got my tribes, but they tend to be pretty small and sparse.
No, that's fair. I think some people are far too, their standards for tribal connection are far too low. And they'll just jump into a...
Well, especially when you're young, there's a lot of that wanting to belong. That's a very big thing.
Right, right, right.
That's the thing. I don't want to belong as much these days. We're out of time, people, so I want to get this guy out of my house. Mm. Go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghead.com, and tell us how exceptional your country is. Also, like us on Facebook, because I said so. And don't forget to, this fall, start catching brand new episodes of... Equinoxious and Solstitious Tuesdays at 8.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.